I mean, my school, again, like they didn't know how to deal with this. It was kind of unheard of at the time. And the best they could do, the guidance counselor put a group together of the other two kids that had been in treatment. So there's three of us. Well-intentioned idea, to kind of try to connect us and create a support group. But you put like the three
Drug addicts.
most hardcore addicts in the school together.
Now you're on out.
And so then I got introduced to other substances and, heroin becoming the final one that ended up leading to a fentanyl overdose.
Connect with us on the Emotion Wellness Podcast for a transformative journey of human connection. Witness personal stories, improve your mental health education, and acquire valuable resources for optimizing your well-being. And visit emotionwellness.com for more information.
Welcome back to the show. My name is Jason Turner. This is the Emotion Wellness Podcast. And today I'm here with Mr. Frank
Man, it's always good to be here. And we switched it up today. We got me in a different chair. So you're going to be seeing me in this chair now. And I got the shirt on today. So we're rocking the new swag, which I'm feeling. I'm feeling
the old
college.
poncho.
I do. I'm not this whole vibe. I'm feeling the kicks. So we got the primitive kicks. And we got all the way from Arizona, one of Jason's good friends from 20 years ago, Peter Doyle. Welcome to the show,
Thank
brother.
you. Thank you.
Welcome coming down all the way from Arizona, man. How was your trip coming down?
It was tough. Got a big delay, about 3.5 hours, and they had to change the planes, but all good. Just so amazing to be here and get to catch up with Jason and see, his work, in the flesh. Been watching, from afar and been a big fan of his for a long time. But yeah, it's totally different seeing it and feeling it.
What do you, I mean, we're going to dive into like your guys' relationship and you, but real quick, just for my own curiosity, like what is your vibe of everything that we have going on down here, dude?
Yeah. I mean, I think, sitting with like the staff, in their team meeting before the groups, I mean, the culture, like, was just amazing. I mean, you could just tell everybody was genuinely like relaxed, happy to be there, excited for the day, very intentional with how they were getting ready for the groups. Certainly a not surprised. I mean, one thing Jason's done since I've known him, probably one of his biggest skills that I've seen is just bringing like amazing people together and like surrounding himself with that and connecting people. And so certainly felt that. And then obviously like the center, the aesthetic, the vibe, all of it from the top down, you can just tell it's different. And different in a really good way, like just a really positive energy overall.
Amazing. Yeah, I mean, this is what drew me. I mean, I've known him and what he's capable of, what he's done here. He's put it together. So going back to what you guys, you said that you've known him for so long. Take me back. When did you guys first meet?
Sure. Yeah, I think that would be 2007. I was 17. I was in a residential treatment center for adolescents for substance abuse and co-occurring disorders, and Jason became one of the staff there. And so I met him, through that.
How many
And
years ago was this?
coming up on 20.
So, dude, you were like 3 years sober.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, so what's wild, and I wanted to
this is
answer.
Gonna be cool.
Well, this is
for
what I was
me.
telling, this is what I was telling him. So when
And you guys.
it's like that, I don't have kids, right? But people go through, and you've had this experience in your families where like the grandparents are like, "Oh my God, you're so big," and it puts people in a perspective of like, "Oh, I'm aging," because they see the young people
Of
getting older.
course, yeah.
So for him to say like we go back 20 years was one way of thinking about it, and it didn't really hit me. But knowing him at like such a young age and going through the program, for him to say he had 20 years sober, it just hit different. I was like, "Holy shit!" Like, it's wild, and that's super cool to have somebody with that 17 maintain 20 years of
Oh my
sobriety.
God, dude. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, what has that been like, dude? Like 20 years of like, what was it that brought you in to treatment? Was that your first treatment stint when you went
No,
there?
no. To first off, it's kind of strange. In like recovery programs, when they talk about like what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, it's strange when you're what it's like now is 20 years, and you're what it's like before was like a few. Just thinking about like my career of substance abuse versus like the length of recovery. It's like most of my story feels so much more relevant, like as an adult, like in recovery
Of
and the stuff
course.
I've had to go through in that. So I had been to short-term inpatient treatment. I mean, I started, I think, using drugs in like 8th grade.
Yeah.
Smoking pot and drinking like everybody else, but and I spent a lot of time in therapy, obviously, when I was young, like trying to dissect and understand like how did this happen? That was like a big, seemed like a big question, you know, from myself, my family, like a lot of therapy back then was kind of based around that. How did I end up in this position? Like as a 16-year-old, you know, the last day I, you know, before I got into recovery was an overdose on fentanyl and almost lost my life. And I was in the hospital for, you know, 4 or 5 days.
Wow.
And yeah, and like, so, and the town I was from, you know, I grew up in a suburb of Chicago that was a really nice town. And it was like not something that happened there, you know, small town, right? And so, yeah, it was, you know, the kind of this question for like years, you know, the first few years of how, you know, how did this happen? And I don't know, you know, like there's my story, you know, was confusing to me for a while because there was no major trauma. I have a great family. My parents were married and I wasn't abused, neglected or anything like that. But ever since I can remember in my life, as young as I can remember, I've just had this horrible like self-critic, like negative thought pattern in the back and like extremely critical. And I always felt, you know, like other people were living an experience I didn't get to live, if that made sense. Mm-hmm. I felt really uncomfortable socially. I felt, you know, kind of flat and like not, like I would get excited about things I'd see other kids get excited about. And then when I first used drugs, it was like, oh my gosh, you know, like so many of us experience, like this is, I didn't know life could be this great. And then very quickly, you know, it was clear that like my relationship with substances was a lot different than the kids around me. Mm-hmm. And it kind of went off to the races from there. And so, you know, I first went to treatment to a short-term 30-day inpatient treatment in Illinois. After, you know, taking a bunch of benzos from my mom and, you know, having a rough week with that. And my dad ended up taking me to the hospital because I was just slurring my words and kind of in a blackout. And you know, in that process, I really, really, really wanted to change. Like it was genuine. Like I wanted to be sober. I didn't want to keep living the way I was living. I hated the double life. I hated the secrecy. I hated the obsession, I think, was like the hell for me. It was like every day, like I need to get high, and I need to figure out how I'm going to do it. And as a 16-year-old, like back then, this is like before marijuana was legal and like the internet wasn't loaded as now, like that was more of a puzzle every day, you know, in a lot of ways, solving that, you know. And so I really wanted to change. I wanted to be sober, but I, you know, 30-day treatment, went back home, and I remember because it was the year the Bears were in the Super Bowl. But yeah, I got drunk like the first weekend out of it with my friends, and then it was just off to the races. And, you know, from there, I think after that time of like, you know, they say like, once you have like self-awareness, you know, it kind of really creates like the hell of it after.
Oh yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And so kind of knowing what was wrong with me, and knowing that there was another way, but like feeling completely powerless, is when things started to get really dark. Yeah, that led me to a path. I mean, my school, again, like they didn't know how to deal with this. It was kind of unheard of at the time. And the best they could do, the guidance counselor put a group together of the other two kids that had been in treatment. So there's three of us. Well-intentioned idea, you know, to kind of try to connect us and create a support group. But you put like the three
drug addicts,
most hardcore addicts in the school together.
Now you're running.
Yeah. And so then I got introduced to other substances and, you know, heroin becoming the final one that ended up leading to a fentanyl overdose. But, you know, it's so wild to me looking back, like it feels like another life at this point, you know, having been so young and so far removed now, it's hard for me to really like envision like that I would do that. It feels like a different person, you know, and thinking like now, you know, as a parent myself and, you know, being like absolutely terrified if my kids got their helmet on when they're riding their bike and like, let's, you know, look both ways and hold hands when we cross the street. And my son's like, I'm 8, dad, like I can cross the street. And then I think like when I was 16, like driving into the inner city of Chicago to buy heroin off the street. And I'm like, what? Like, oh my God. But that was the reality, you know, when I woke up, you know, from overdosing and, you know, I just remember feeling this immense sense of relief that the gig was up. I knew I didn't have to keep like lying anymore. But also just this complete apathy about like having a second chance or anything like that. Like, and just thinking of how a 16-year-old can get to that place. Like your life hasn't even started.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of what's driven me, you know, for the last 20 years since of like working in this field and working with young people specifically and just trying to help that and, you know, show these guys a different way, a hope, you know, that they didn't think was possible, that they can feel different and life doesn't have to be like this.
When did you, So you went through treatment. When did you, like, when did that idea become prevalent to you that you wanted to step into this industry?
Yeah. So I went through treatment. I was in treatment for a long time. The program I went to a wilderness therapy program for about 3 months. And then I went to a long-term residential where I ended up meeting Jason, and that was about a year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Year-long program.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Yeah. And then I went on to like a transitional living kind of step down place for young adults after that. And I hadn't really thought about working in the field at all until I got a call, you know, I don't know how long, shortly after I had finished treatment, was living on my own. And they asked if I wanted to be a peer facilitator in one of the outpatient groups, like to assist a therapist, basically. And I said, yeah. And so in doing that, I was just like, I just remember feeling so alive, you know. It was kind of like, just, you know, in the early days of recovery too, like just, you know, sponsoring people or working with others and like just this like life feeling, right? Like it was so amazing.
I don't understand.
And I just felt so alive and like so fired up and, just like I could use what I had been through and the pain I had been through. And all I had to do was like be me and share my experience, and get to be helpful. And, you know, kind of when you go through something really hard and dark and then you get to use it to help others get out of their hard and dark, you know, it's kind of a really beautiful, like healing process that obviously you guys are super aware of, you know? Yeah. And so that kind of just led me on that path and I wanted more. And I worked for Jason, for a long time too, at a young adult transition living program. I was like a direct care staff and he was the manager there. And that was incredible. And then, you know, my goal always was to take Jason's job one day, you know, when Jason moved on, I knew he would, you know, and I did that eventually and I got to be, and that was a really cool experience, right? I mean, I had everything I'd learned from him and, working under him and then to get to be, you know, the director of that facility, was a huge accomplishment, you know, and just a really cool moment for me. And so, yeah, that's kind of, I've been in operations, you know, for about 12 years, running programs and then, you know, recently transitioned into just being a therapist, which has been really amazing in its own way.
What is your credential?
So I have a master's degree in addiction counseling. I'm a licensed addiction counselor in Arizona.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Amazing.
Thank you.
So dude, so wow, you guys have a lot of history together. I didn't realize all that. Yeah. To unpack here.
Yeah.
So, okay. So what was it like? What was the experience with you and his relationship in actual treatment? Like what made you connect and stay connected?
Yeah.
Let's dive into that a little
for
bit.
For sure. I mean, I remember, I mean, and again,
what was he like? He always talks about me.
Yeah.
Like looking like you.
Yeah, no, he was bigger. He was a big dude. He was a lot bigger than me. This was bodybuilding Jason. So, I mean,
he, any pictures of this?
He must have been.
I've none. I know.
I was close to 300.
He must have been, yeah, I was going to say about 280 pounds.
I would love to see what you looked like.
You know, just this jacked, huge, bald tattoo guy, know. And for me as like a kid, I was
3 years
like,
oh my of sobriety God. To
Yeah. And he was so passionate about it and spoke with such conviction, you know, about recovery and this other way of life and how good it can be. And I mean, that just immediately grabbed my attention, you know, as this young kid. I mean, he ended up being, you know, definitely like one of the most profound mentors, you know, personally I've had in my entire life. I mean, and I think, you know, I remember when I got out of treatment, you know, they didn't have a lot of like halfway house type stuff with this facility back then. There wasn't a lot of alumni. I was one of the like earlier clients to go to this place. So after living with a bunch of people for a year and a half, all of a sudden at 18 now, done with treatment, I got an apartment completely by myself, you know, because that was like the next step. Mm-hmm. And that was like my first time in sobriety, you know, outside of treatment. I was 18. I was in Tucson and it got dark, man. Like it got really dark for me and I stayed sober, but, I wouldn't call it like a high quality of life. I mean, I was just isolating and didn't know how to function, didn't know how to reach out for help, didn't know how to, and then, you know, after about 6 or 8 months of that, you know, I got a call from Jason. He's like, hey, I got this place and do you want to rent a room? And I mean, that alone, like probably saved my life like that. Cause I was so like just a isolated creature.
Well, we didn't see him around, so it was like you kind of knew, you know, and I had a lot of respect for him as a human, but in a client role, there's so many clients that, you know, it's not their fault, right? A lot of times people want, it's easy to blame them, but there's like this treatment, they call it treatment savvy, but really they've just been conditioned to give responses that'll help ease like the spotlight and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And Peter was just so this is where we jive. It's why we drive. It's like real and authentic. He was, he's never the guy in group that's going to be like, let me tell you what you want to hear.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's like, that landed, that sucked. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, and it, and if you weren't, I mean, I definitely have way more skill today. I mean, it's 20 years later, but even back then it was like, you could tell he's a great barometer for like where things are at. You know what I mean? So he was like the, he was not the cooler, so to speak, but like, if you wanted to know how things were, you just talk to Peter, cause you know, you're going to get a straight. So we related in that way and, had just thought of him fondly. And so while doing the job, it was like, well, I don't really see him around. I know he's not plugged in. And then it was like, and I was thinking about like, if I had this place, who would I want to help and who would I want to be around? You don't want to just live with some. So that's when I reached out to him, and I didn't know he was as dark, but I knew that, yeah, he probably would benefit from getting plugged in. You know what I mean? So
then what, from there, what happened? You started working?
Yeah. So I was living with Jason, and we had a couple other roommates at the time. And I was working for the company, and you know, I mean, gosh, it's hard to even remember.
Was everyone there working for the company?
No, at the house?
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah. That's cool, dude.
Yeah.
That's
pretty cool.
It was the girl was Peter, Eddie. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we had a house up front that was like, the guy owned two houses. So I rented the back one, and the front was like a sober living. Mm-hmm. And then we used to have these men's meetings with the Candle of Truth, and they were like super dope.
That's cool.
We have to talk about that for a minute, because that's like one of the coolest memories. I mean, so
let's hear about it, dude. This is like
Jason cool would
shit.
Get like, yeah, yeah, I mean, cool it would stuff, be like a Friday night or something.
Going down my memory lane.
I mean, it would be like a Friday night, and you'd have like 20 dudes in this house, and it would be like guys from all over. Mm-hmm. I mean, the age range would be like 18 to, I remember one 60, guy, I swear it was 60 something that you had in that group. Yeah.
That's so cool though about recovery.
Yeah. And like guys that were like one of my best friends in the world, he was the best man at my wedding. I met because of Jason and connecting us. And it's just funny thinking about that connection. Like, so I'm like from this nice suburb of Chicago, and my best friend, you know, on this planet was like this super tough gangster guy from like south side of Tucson. And so it's like you've got this mix of guys in this room, and Jason's got the lights off, a candle going, like feathers and shit, you know. And it's like, and you've got some of these like really hardcore dudes like crying and spilling their guts out to a room full of men. Dude. Yeah. And it was just like the most powerful stuff, you know? And this was a long time ago, right? This was before the, like, you know, now you see the like men's retreats where they're like howling in the woods together, you know? This was way before anything like that. And so, you know,
I was way ahead of my time.
Yeah. Wow, yeah.
I really were.
And just think about, yeah, again, like that conviction, like him knowing like, this is powerful, like this is medicine. Right. And like, to present that to like all these dudes and get them bought in, you know, like, hey, so you only speak if you're holding the feather.
it helps when you're almost 300 pounds.
And angry. It did help. Yeah. His aura.
It helped break down walls too.
Yeah,
dude,
his aura was more intense back then.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, those kinds of things, and just the community that he plugged in, like, it was always like anytime there was a UFC event or some sort of thing, it was Jason inviting everybody he could, barbecuing for everybody, like food's on him, house is open to anybody, you know, and just always kind of creating this like community rooted in like, you know, self-improvement and like people trying to change their life, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's obviously now when I walk into emotion, it's like, oh yeah, it's just that, you know, there it is again. I know this feeling, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And seeing all the people and kind of hearing a little bit about what brought them there. And I'm like, yep, you know, here it is. You know, he just has that gift, right? And there's something about that. So yeah, it was really cool to see like the full circle. I'm like, oh, I felt this before.
And you guys, how long did you work under him?
Man, I don't know how long that was. What was it, like 8 years?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Holy, wow.
Yeah, and then he moved on to Prescott after that, yeah.
Wow. Where'd you move on to from there?
Another went to Prescott to be a therapist. You know, there was bad breakup, like felt like my time was up, mm-hmm. and I had just graduated. It was 2014, so yeah, because you said 07, mm-hmm. like 2014 2015, I just was like, I think I need to go get a new experience, you know. This has been great, but I also, and he just spoke to it earlier, it's like there's this thing for someone who's wired like me, wired like Peter, where we have rare skill set, in that from a therapeutic standpoint, not a lot of therapists are operations, business. Like mm-hmm. it's hard to be really good at
everything. Both. Yeah.
And because of that, we were talking about this earlier, like when you're really good at engaging people, you move up the ranks because this industry has it ass backwards where business development and administration makes the money and the people who change lives don't. So if you want to get a good quality of life, you have to sort of leave the thing that you love. Right. And so I decided I wanted to go back to that and be more involved with like one-on-one mm-hmm. and learn about I was really being called to learn about trauma. And I can't tell you why. So when I interviewed at this place in Prescott, they offered to give me a somatic experiencing trauma training as part of my like hiring thing. And that's why I went. It's really the one reason I went to that spot. And then I just stayed up there. And from there, I came to Texas.
Mm. How long did you stay up there for?
Like 5 years.
Five more years.
4 or 5 years. I remember leaving and like was real clear with the family. I was like, Peter's your guy. Like you'd be a fool not to like sort of had my eye on him for a long time. Cause that's what you do. Right. Like I knew I didn't want to be here forever. And so who's going to be the replacement? Mm-hmm. You know? So it was cool that it worked out that way. So,
and how long did you stay at that facility?
Well, so that was the young adult transitional living. I think I was the manager there for a couple years. And then I went to the adolescent boarding school that they have. And I was the program director there for about 10 years. And then I just recently switched to being just a therapist only about 6 months ago or something like that. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
How do you enjoy that versus?
I love it. You know, like Jason spoke to, like what fired me up about this work, what I fell in love with, what like gave me that feeling in the beginning, you know, that purpose, that feeling alive, like it was working with clients but then you find yourself being valuable in these different roles and you want to build a career. And so you keep kind of moving up it got to the point where I knew my time was up. And for me, what was driving me crazy the last couple of years of that program director role is, I knew I wasn't performing my best. I knew I wasn't all in, and nobody else knew that, you know, because I still was like, obviously like well equipped to do the job well, mm-hmm. and nobody would have any idea. But to me, it was killing me. Mm-hmm. And it was a weight that I just felt getting heavier and heavier, where I knew that, my passion and love for that specific role had started to die out. And, eventually I just, you know, was like, I have to make a change. And, you know, it was it was a scary change, you know. I basically quit my job, and started a new job. And, about 2 weeks after I did that, my wife said, oh, I'm pregnant with our third child. And so I was like, oh, okay. Kind of regretting quitting my, you know, but it was perfect actually. Cause I would have never done it. Had I known, I would have just played it safe and, mm-hmm. you know, and then I would have been stuck and it would have just gotten worse. And it's really hard for me to feel good about what I'm doing if I don't feel like I'm like really all in on it.
I understand that.
You know, and, so that was just starting to eat at me. So getting to just switch back into just a therapist role. I mean, it's just lit all the fires again about why I do what I do, and just getting to try to do like whatever we can do to try to help people, you know, and like mm-hmm. what can we figure out, you know, and outside of the box, inside the box, whatever, and really just building like quality relationships with people and getting to feel really connected, you know, versus sometimes when you're just at, you know, the high level of operations, it feels very lonely and disconnected, you know, management, right? And yeah, and even the clients, you're just kind of like the administrator, you know, so you lose a lot of the stuff you fall in love with.
The magic. Yeah. Of why
it's also really challenging when it's not about like anything wrong with it. It's just that when you're not the one in control,
yeah,
or you have all of the responsibility but limited on power, mm-hmm. you know, that's the real challenge for someone in that role. And so when you can have both, it's way different, you know, like in the role that I'm in now, the role that we're trying to create and mm-hmm. some of the things that we're trying to do here, it's like within each department, it's like trying to give people the creative freedom to make those decisions so that you do feel like there's ownership versus mm-hmm. like, oh, I'm just executing the wishes and demands,
the checkbox that they want.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have to get all these people that trust me and believe in me to agree with it, even if I don't necessarily. And so doing that, it just became very like, it felt like impossible to be authentic anymore when you're at a certain point, like Jason's talking about, like when you're a leader but you're not the leader, And it's like, I know that if I'm not positive and energetic and motivating and excited about these things, then my culture will suffer, staff will suffer, clients will suffer. But I think the idea is maybe bad, and I don't know how to, like, you know, manage that incongruence. And so that takes a toll on you over time. You know?
Oh, I understand that wholeheartedly.
It's hard when you're faced with, like, I have to let down the people that I care about. If I'm going to serve this other master and be a good employee, I have to subscribe to this thing that maybe I don't fully believe in. And if I don't do this, so it's really a lose-lose, because it's like, if I serve my subordinates, I'm not honoring the wishes of the people above me. And then if I do that, then I'm not, you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like one of those.
It's a very,
it sucks.
You're stuck. Shitty situation.
And for me, I was just tired. That's why, you know, we're here, because I just couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah, that's why I said no till the third time.
Don't worry.
It had nothing to do with you or treatment. I get it. It was like, do I want to do this? Which I'm so grateful I did.
Yeah, dude. I mean, I was like, I want to do this.
Drama around working in this industry. But yeah, the only way I could have done it is through is the loyalty and the trust that we have with one another. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's more important than anything. So, dude, so, all right, so you guys worked together for 8 years. What has, how long have you been now working in the industry as a whole?
I started in 2008. So, oh, wow. I don't know what that is, about 18 some years. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was direct care staff for a long time, and then just moved up into like middle management and then program operations director. And I got the master's degree along the way just to help out with that. But then really got fired up about the idea of, you know, therapy, and, you know, a lot of it through, you know, Jason and some of the stuff along the way, you know, that I learned from him and seeing what he was doing. Because I had when I was young, I had kind of a incomplete or maybe disconnected experience with just traditional talk therapy. You know, it wasn't one of the things I looked back and been like, that really was a needle mover of like me getting better or feeling better. But then, you know, through kind of growing up and seeing some of the different things out there and everything Jason was doing about, I'm like, oh, like therapy doesn't just have to exist on the couch, you know, and it's not just, and oftentimes, especially with young men, like that's like contraindicated, you know, like that's not the right approach. Mm-hmm. And so just kind of broadening my horizon of like what therapy is and could be and what it can look like. And that got me really excited, and it's been amazing.
He's got like, he put a plunge in, he's got kids. Yeah. So he's doing this in Arizona, you know,
he's doing it out there.
Yeah. We got a sauna, cold plunge. I mean, when it started, I just got one of those little cheap ice buckets and I put it out to the students. I was like, hey, if anybody wants to try this, it's going to be really early in the morning, so it's not going to interfere with your schedule. You're not going to get out of anything to do this. But if you want to do it, I'll be here at, you know, 5:30 in the morning or whatever. And this was in the winter, you know, and so it was pretty cold, you know, even in Arizona.
How old are these kids?
These kids are 15 to 17.
Yeah.
And at first one kid showed up. And he was like kind of my buddy, so I figured he'd be down, and we did it. And then he told everybody how amazing it was. And then the next day, like three kids showed up. And within a week, you know, I brought it on the weekend, and there was like 20 kids lined up to do this thing. Wow. And we're just running them through this cold plunge. And that's when I really got to see like the power of, you know, like what that was doing, like the camaraderie, you know, aspect, the pride after they did it, the like, oh, I went 3 minutes, you know, you got to go 3 minutes, the like supporting each other while they're in it. And when I see one kid talking to the next before he goes in about like, hey, here's what it's going to feel like when you get in, here's how you got to do your breathing, like you can do this, you know? And I was like, okay, like there's a lot of magic to this, especially with young, you know, young men.
Yeah, right? Dude.
And then obviously, you know, all the physiology and the benefits of how they felt after, but just the camaraderie and the culture of it was really special, you know, kind of starting that. And then the program eventually invested in a really nice cold plunge, a sauna. Now they use it weekly, you know, in group format, and it's been a game changer.
That's amazing, bro. We always say, right, community and environment is what's going to be the greatest interventions,
right? I mean, for these guys, I think what's tough for anybody, I mean, this probably applies to everybody, but you know, people are suffering, and like when they come to treatment or therapy, like you're suffering, like I was suffering, you guys are all suffering, and I'm not good at suffering. Like that's why I loved like things that made me not suffer as much, like drugs, you know? Yeah. And so if you don't have something that can make them feel better quickly, you lose them.
Mm-hmm.
And talk therapy and traditional is amazing. I love it, but it takes time. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it takes some time. I got to build a rapport. Mm-hmm. You got to trust me. We got to get into some work. You might have to do some homework and practice some of these skills. But you know, exercise cold plunge even better because I don't have to make them like, you know, it's easier access. I just throw them in and they feel great in 2 minutes, you know, they don't have to work super hard. Sauna, you know, breath work, things that allow, you know, especially these young guys that I work with, like to change their state quickly. And that's where, you know, I think it's a huge beneficial tool because a lot of the traditional kind of treatment approaches, even like medication, like Prozac and things like, it takes time. And for some of these guys, like, man, there's no time. Like I can't, he's not going to suffer for 8 weeks. He's going to leave. He's going to, you know, for some of these guys that are 18, like they're going to sign out. They're out of here. You know, they're going to think this is not for me. This doesn't work. Like people can't wait that long when they're in pain, you know? So,
one of the things that the guy who, the CEO for the EMR, his one of his sayings is impact is the only metric. And so that's what you're like, if you can't impact, you're not going to get anywhere with any of these young guys. So it's good. You gotta be impactful. And what does that look like? And you know, most of them are struggling with communicating. So to start with communicating when it's the most efficient aspect of their life is not the best, you know, utility when you're trying to get someone to change. So
yeah. What do you got?
So talk to Peter about, ask him about some of his, the guys of savage. We're talking, could have picked any sport and like done whatever he wanted. I'm convinced of that. But just talk to him about his accomplishments physically. Cause
yeah, you are a physical specimen.
He's got some cool.
What is it? What does it look like? Like, what is your well, yeah, let's go back to what are some of your accomplishments?
Sure.
And then what does your regimen do too? Yeah. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, first, I mean, you know, when I talked about like, when I look back on my recovery journey and kind of my story, in therapy, not necessarily being one that stood out to me as like this game changer, fitness definitely was the needle mover, above anything else at first, you know, I think that, you know, you talk about changing your state and being able to change how you feel. I mean, I went all in, you know, when I went to treatment, they had a gym and just felt the benefits right away and became very invested in that. And, you know, Jason was a huge mentor in that. And he was a huge believer, obviously, back then. He was huge and super strong and jacked. And so, yeah, I fell in love with fitness and just went all in on that. Eventually, yeah, I think this was actually when I was like a little older. I didn't compete in a ton of stuff when I was young. I just liked lifting and training, and we would do a lot of trips. Like Jason and I went to Zion and Havasupai Falls a bunch of times. So we do these big cool hikes and things like that. So fitness was a huge part of my life. But when I was about 26, I randomly on YouTube found a sport called the Scottish Highland Games. And really underrepresented sport, like super cool. I would love, to put that out there because I know you guys have a big fitness community. Like people get into powerlifting, people get into CrossFit, people get into strongman, but the Scottish Highland Games is really cool. And so,
what is it?
Yeah, it's basically it's kind of like the Olympic throwing events where they come from, like shot put, discus, things like that. You know, the signature event is the caber toss, which is where the guy is running with like a big telephone pole and kind of flips end over end. So there's 9 different kind of throwing events. You have to wear a kilt in competition, which I thought was fun.
I've seen this on ESPN.
And so it felt like a real sport to me versus like when I, you know, some of the powerlifting and things like that felt like, the gym was the sport. And so like, it didn't like hype me up quite as much, but this felt like there was training and there was practice and there was a sport. And what was really cool too, is the festivals, it's all the Celtic, like Scottish festivals in cities. This is like an entertainment of the festival. So you really got to feel like an athlete, you know, in a lot of ways, like this whole crowd of people that are at this festival, are like watching, they're like, whoa, what are you doing? And they got announcers kind of reading off the scores and people are cheering for you. And so it was really a really fun experience. I randomly, you know, had a lot of success in it. I fell in love with it. When I get really into something, though, I can get pretty hyper-focused and pretty into it. So that certainly happened.
So what was the success like?
Yeah.
He doesn't want to talk about it.
Yeah, right.
He's like,
that's why I asked
him. He's like very like, he's not, I want to.
Yeah.
Let's hear about it.
I won 2 national championships.
Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah. And I had a.
Were you on ESPN too?
No, they didn't have.
I've seen it on like.
They didn't have us on ESPN. Yeah, they used to, the older guys. Yeah, which was really cool to watch. I had a world record. I broke a world record in 2019 in one of the events. It was a weight over bar. So you're basically throwing essentially kind of like a kettlebell, but it's like a chain handle on a weight, and you're standing under almost what's like a field goal post, and you're throwing it with one hand through your legs and throwing it straight up in the air, and it has to go over the bar.
Gotcha. Picture like a javelin where you go up over the bar.
Yeah,
so that's, but you're throwing up.
Still. Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah. And so you know, you can, you clear the height, and then you can go up and up and up and up. And so the previous world record was a 42-pound weight for the division that I was in, and the previous world record was 19 feet. So wow, clearing 19 feet. Dude. So, yeah. Lot, bro. And I didn't expect, like, this was one of my earlier competitions, so I didn't, like, expect to be going for a world record. But, yeah, I cleared, like, 18 feet and 6 inches, and I was like, oh, well, let's go for it. So it set the bar to, like, 19 feet and, like, 4 inches, and you get 3 attempts at each height, and I missed the first 2, and then it was the 3rd attempt. I've got my son in the crowd, and he's got a kilt on. My wife's there, you know, cheering for me, and I just got super hyped up and cleared it. Yeah, they, like, steel tape measured it to, like, verify it all, and it ended up being 19 feet 1 inch, so I broke it by 1 inch.
Nice.
But, yeah, that was just a really cool, it was a really cool, like, side quest of my life. Yeah. It was a lot of fun. So I got to travel a bit and compete. I got to go, like, coach a clinic in Alaska, and I'd never been to Alaska before. So that was really cool, and met a lot of great people and had a lot of fun. And then, yeah, you know, I recognized that, like, for my body, like, there's not a longevity, not a lot of longevity in spinning around and torquing my back with these heavy weights. And my son was starting to get more into his sports. So I was like, all right, let's focus on that.
How do you train for that?
Yeah. So you have to be strong. So you got to lift weights, but then you got to throw a lot because it's super technical. You know,
right.
It's a lot. It's like 9 events is a lot to practice.
This is that big log. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And isn't it like when you throw the log, it's not just about it flipping.
It's accuracy.
It has to be like, yeah, if it's to the right or to the left, you get dinged, right?
Exactly.
It's about,
right,
getting it like at
it's
12
like
o'clock.
Clock face. Yeah. Yeah. 12 o'clock is a perfect score in front of you. Yeah. So it's an accuracy event. Exactly. Not like in a lot of them, like the weights are heavy, like the caber is what they call that. It could be heavy, but it's not pure strength, you know, it's really a timing and accuracy and like power at the exact right moment, if that makes sense. But yeah, how you train with it is kind of a fun quirk of the sport, because that's a real logistical variable to figure out, because those weights destroy the ground when you throw them. And so you kind of have to find these random places that like you can do this and nobody's going to like call the cops on you or something. So the best place I had was like a park that had an empty sand volleyball pit. That was like my favorite spot. So I could throw the weights into the sand volleyball pit and go get them out. But yeah, it's a weird, I feel like it was like one step above like LARPing, you know, like, like if I had like sword fighting, you know, but it was really cool and a lot of fun, and I'm glad I did it.
How long did you train? Like, how long was that?
Part of my life.
2 national championships.
Yeah, it was all really fast.
I mean, world champion or national?
So I got 4th at the world championships. I got 2 national championship titles. I got 4th.
Where did you do the world championship?
It was in Tucson.
Oh, get
The year they had it in Tucson. So I was like, oh, yeah, absolutely, I'll do it. The national championships were Salt Lake City and then in somewhere in Ohio. I forget. It was like small town. That was like the COVID year. So it was like really weird and kind of thrown together.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I think I did it from like 2017 to like 2022, something like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
So high performance athlete.
I guess. I mean, if you know, here's the secret. I'll tell you, if you want to be really good at something, find something that very few people do. Magically, you can be a world record holder and a 2-time national champion.
Yeah, right. It
still takes quite a bit.
Yeah. It was a lot of work, but yeah, I had a blast for sure. So
I feel like he's wired this way too, and tell me if I'm wrong, but it's like Peter looks at like, he's like, CrossFit, everybody's doing that. I don't want to do that. Like, I got to find something that like
no one's doing.
Yeah, because I'm wired that way. It's like, I don't want to just do what everybody else is doing.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I really wanted to like those, like what I wanted to feel like I was playing a sport, you know? And so what's cool about that sport is like when you're competing against somebody, it's like, okay, he just threw 40 feet. I have to beat him or else.
Yeah.
And this is my last attempt. Can I step in with the whole crowd, with everybody watching me, one shot to do this perfect? If my technique is off in any way, you know, those moments I really like loved. It just really brought me like to life, you know, and just stepping in like, all right, this is it, you know, and that kind of pressure felt really fun. And then when you hit it, it's like the best feeling ever. And, you know, and so it was a lot of fun.
Is that part of the those things called the Denny Stones?
Denny Stones? Yeah. So those are definitely like a deep part of the Scottish heritage. And a lot of times at these Highland Games, they'll have like weird strength competition offshoots after for the athletes too. Well, they'll do like mock Denny stones, who can hold it the longest, or you're picking up a big Atlas stone and running with it, yeah. You know, who can carry this the fastest. So it's definitely kind of like this, you know, it's a big drinking culture, obviously, right, at these festivals. So it certainly feels like, you know, kind of this, vibe of like, you know, guys sitting around drinking and be like, hey, who can lift that heavier rock? You know what I mean? But that taps into like some fun primal stuff, you know,
even though for me.
Yeah. So it's a good time.
Oh man, that's freaking cool, dude. So let me ask you this. What does your like regimen look like today?
Sure.
Because you look amazing.
Thank you.
How old are you?
I'm 36, about to be 37 in a couple weeks.
About to be 37 and you have how many kids?
I have two kids, one on the way.
Mm-hmm. So it's not easy.
No.
And you work full time.
Yeah.
What does it look like?
Yeah.
You know, what does your daily practice look like, even just to keep yourself regulated outside of just your physical, like your sobriety practice? What does all that look like?
No, that's a good question. I think, you know, my fitness has changed a lot and it's had to change a lot. And, you know, given kids and a wife and a career and all these different things. And Jason actually helped me a lot with this when I was younger, because he saw it. And I think he saw it because he had had it too. But I remember him really kind of calling me out on like, hey, like I love that you love this fitness thing and it's helping you so much, but it can't be everything. Mm-hmm. And him kind of bringing that to my, like, you have to have more than just that. And so he was totally right. But yeah, so now obviously like on my priority list, it's a lot lower than I ever thought it would be. And I like it there, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, honestly, if I've been training for so long that really, as long as I can work out, lift weights maybe 3 times a week. And then, you know, ideally some cardio on the days off, or just walking the dog with the kids, you know, or playing sports with the kids. And then really it's just about, you know, eating clean, trying to sleep as best as I can, which, as you know, the kids is difficult. But yeah, as long as I think consistency and like compliance are the real science of like fitness, right? So I always tell people, like, find some style of training that you enjoy, because you need to do it for the next decade before you're like really pumped about, you know, and that's when you'll really get some like impressive results, is just so falling in love with the process. And for me, like, yeah, I love it just as much as ever. I just know that like I have bigger priorities right now, being, you know, my children and my wife and everything. And so a lot of it is, though, like, you know, I guess sometimes I got to get up at 4 a.m. if I want to go to the gym, you know, like that's the dad hour, right? You used to kind of see that movement on Instagram, which I love, like the dad hour. I'm like, yeah, you know, go
to early, before everyone's awake.
Yeah, and then you get to do the dad thing and like remind everyone how early you got up that day.
I've
been up since 4:30.
I gotta go to sleep.
Yeah,
if I'm gonna get up early, like that. Yeah,
but yeah, in terms of like the overall picture, you know, and I think that also goes into like really helping me stay balanced and regulated, like recovery and nervous system wise, because I can train too much and it can be a harmful thing, you know? And so for me, it's about balance with everything else. And, you know, meditation is huge, like mindfulness meditation. I love breath work. But for me, really, like, what moves the needle the most in my day to day is mindfulness based meditation, and really, you know, working through that. A lot of it is like proper scheduling and like planning my time out, like in terms of like what can move the needle on like sanity and like stress reduction, like scheduling, communication. I mean, I have consider myself like extremely lucky to have what I think is like the coolest wife in the world. And so she helps me a ton, and she's in recovery. And so she's just like always an inspiration of like, oh yeah, I should probably meditate. You know, she's praying, meditating, she's journaling, she's like talking to friends for support. And I'm like, God, she's like, oh, I better start doing that, you know? Like,
yeah.
And so all of that really helps. But yeah, I think, you know, quieting the storm in my mind comes through like a balance of, yeah, like physical health, routine and connection and yeah, managing my stress day to day, which through me is scheduling appropriately, having good boundaries, not taking on too much. I'm prone to like overload myself and, you know, put way too much on my plate and then be like, why do I not feel good? You know, things like
that. What has been some of like the, you know, 'cause you have 20 years of sobriety and you have a lot more time sober than you had out using, which is cool. Like, I think of that for me nowadays, you know, I'm at that point in my
life. It's like to be sober longer than you were alive when you got sober.
Yeah.
Like, what have been some of the challenges in your journey of, you know, recovery and sobriety over the past 20 years that you've, you know, maybe for the listeners that could gain some insight from?
Yeah. I mean, certainly in the beginning when I was younger, I mean, obviously there's this kind of like grief process in your head of, you know, those college years feeling like I'm missing out, right? Or I'm giving up, or I'm living this abnormal life. I think it's a little better now. I feel like it's a little bit more mainstream to maybe be healthier and be more health conscious and things. But 20 years ago now, I mean, my whole life, every college movie, you know, about what college was, everybody talked to me, was just this and nonstop party, right? So definitely felt like I was losing something at first, you know, a lot of the time, right? And then later it really set in like, oh my gosh, what a gift, you know, and what a better experience I feel like I had than I would have, obviously. Mm-hmm. I think it was hard, you know, at times for those early years, like, you know, raw dogging life, you know, as people say, right? Like, mm-hmm. that's not easy, you know, especially when you're young and like dating and meeting people and going out and traveling and like trying to live a life with no substances to like use, you know, in any sort of capacity of either numbing or enhancing or lubricating the social situation. You know, that was tough to have to like do everything just kind of like, you know, with anxiety, with depression and lean on like skills and tools through therapy, recovery, you know, things like that. You know, that was all really difficult, but as the years have gone on, I mean, you know, the gifts are, I can't even, yeah, it's hard to even like fully comprehend. You know, obviously my career, you know, I feel great for my, like I said, my wife in recovery, we met, you know, through that. That's probably been, you know, the greatest part of my life thus far, you know, recovery. Yeah.
How many years?
Yeah. So we met, we first started dating about 16 years ago. And then we got married. We're coming up on our 10th, marriage anniversary here. And,
amazing.
Yeah. And it's funny because like, so her journey, you know, through all this was different than mine. She is, had relapses and like had broken periods of sobriety and struggled, and we've stayed together, you know, through that. And so it's just kind of this different process, but being, you know, in a relationship together and going through that. And I got to learn, you know, a lot, about things, you know, but now it's like, in the beginning, it just felt like this dynamic where like I was really solid and stable and like she was, you know, struggling, and she struggled with that, you know, like kind of narrative, feeling insecure about that. And then now it's like she's like the most evolved, like spiritual badass person I know, like, you know, just like handling life seemingly with ease, no matter how, like her life is way more challenging than mine. And so I'm constantly like, oh man, I gotta keep up, you know, like I gotta keep up. And so I think, you know, I was trying to think about like the coolest thing, you know, in terms of the marriage, and you know, I feel like almost having 10 years, you know, once you get to like 20 years, 30 years, you can really start to like give some marriage advice. I'm not there yet, but I would say from what I've learned thus far, you know, I think marry somebody that inspires you is like the coolest thing.
The best.
And I don't know if everybody gets to have that, you know, but that is like the, just looking at your partner, like in awe, like, holy shit, you know, this person is like really impressive. And not only has that forced me to continue to try to grow, cause it can be easy to try, you know, stagnate, you know, for sure. But yeah, marry somebody that inspires you has certainly been a big, you know, nugget of my success for sure.
I love that, man.
Yeah, I feel like in friendships too.
For sure. Yeah.
You know, that's like been my, I totally agree with you on the marriage thing. And I think in just in life in general, it's like, if I don't have, if you don't inspire me or you don't challenge me or you're not really making a contribution at the table, like
what do we do?
It sounds weird to say it because it feels a little cold, and, but I'm at a stage where like, that's who I want at my table, man. Yeah. Like I don't want to be around people who,
you know, I agree completely.
Create drama and that kind
of
stuff.
Only growth mindset. Because we're a sum of the, they say the sum of the five people we hang around most. I truly believe that, you know, our network will create the direction of our life.
Yeah.
And the most important is your wife.
Right. And then I mean, with that quote, then I feel like, oh shoot, I am one of the five people she's most responsible. That's a responsibility on my end, you know?
Absolutely.
Like, I want to be bringing her up too, you know?
Yeah. It's like I was telling you, it was like our weakness is our family's excuse. So I'm always like, and I'm the critic too. I like a lot of the things that you said I related to. Like I have that perfectionist critic in my head and always checking myself. Like, did I do good enough today for all the areas of my life? And, yeah, man, I just related a lot to a lot of what you've been sharing on here today. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
What I've been reminded of is the word and the concept of consistency. Mm. So I look at like, there's so many people in the last 20 years that have like come through my life. I've had the privilege of experiencing, whether it be at treatment centers or in AA or wherever. And we were talking about like, there's a lot of young kids that didn't get past 24 years old, you know, and I think about, and there's a lot of people who didn't stay the course and were consistent with being inconsistent and like where they're currently at. And then you look at like just, you know, I don't think at 17 you could see this mm-hmm. where you're currently at. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's like two kids, one on the way, beautiful marriage, like gainfully employed, like doing what I love. Like, that's an amazing life. When you're 17, it doesn't sound too exciting because you want all this other stuff, right? But to have stayed the course and seen him physically develop, mentally develop, grow into this, you know, he's a fantastic human being, you know, who's doing service and helping people. And now he's an example. And I think of, there's so many people I've seen who like stopped mm-hmm. or they couldn't for whatever reason. I'm not, who knows why, but they did not engage in the process and continue. And some of those people sadly were either have either passed away or they're in a cycle where they haven't really grown or leveled up. Mm-hmm. Like the level stayed the same, you know, and that's, that's really, so it's the, well, I guess what I'm saying is that the idea and the truth about how powerful consistency is.
So absolutely.
Most people can do the exciting shit, you know, and I, like a lot of the stuff on social is kind of bullshit. I do like a lot of the stuff that Hormozy talks about, and he always hits up like, it's not really, there's a lot to be said for someone getting it started. It's maintaining it when it gets boring. Mm-hmm. Can you stay in it when it's like lost? It's like the excitement. Mm-hmm. And can you stay with the course? And that's what I think 20 years of sobriety is. It's like, going to get boring.
You know, talking about like falling in love with the process, you know, we talked about fitness, but with this too. And, you know, I think about like Atomic Habits a lot, right? And I know you guys are dealing with that, but just this idea of like identity-based goals instead of outcome-based goals and how much more, you know, successful in identities instead of I'm going to lose 20 pounds. I'm a healthy person. I'm becoming a healthy person, right? What does a healthy person do? You know, like I think, some things that were helpful for me is like, I wish I was happier. And then, you know, people like Jason or whoever is like, well, what would you be doing if you were happier? And I'd list the things I think I'd be doing. Well, why don't you do that now? And then all of a sudden you get happier. Right. So, you know, think like you're right. The consistency and how you get that, I think is, you know, identity based, like I have to change the identity, not chasing an outcome. Because anytime I achieve an outcome that I was, you know, the world national championship, for example, I'm grinding, I'm going to beat these guys, I want to win this, I win it. And guess what? Like, I'm happy for a minute. And then like,
it's 19 and 1 inches. It needs to be 19.
Right.
And four.
It's the arrival fallacy, right? You think when I get here, then, and it's always empty, you know? And so you got to have goals. So they're true. Important, but you have to be like, life is not waiting for you. Then life is right now,
right now,
right?
Experience. Embrace it, even the wins and the losses.
Yeah, and it's hard in like the hustle culture, you know, because you think like I gotta grind and achieve this.
There's something down the road. Right. The only thing that really truly matters is today.
Right.
You know, and we have the vision of where we're going and what we're doing, but you have to enjoy the process every day, even if it does suck.
Yeah.
Even if you got a messed up stomach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
You gotta tough it out, man.
Tough it out. You know, upset stomach, hour and a half drive. Yeah. Tough it out.
Yeah.
You
know
what I mean? Well, we're, that's I think what it is, though.
Yeah, it is.
Peter and I were talking recently
back on these days
about, you know, there's so many ways in which you've inspired me with like your energy and your outlook. And it's funny because like the addicted side of my personality, right? And I relate to what you said earlier where it's like another lifetime. Like I don't identify as the thing anymore. Like I'm not, like we talk about the identity, right? Well, if I say I'm an alcoholic, what does that mean? Well, to me, it means I'm drinking. Mm-hmm. To me, it means I'm sick. To me, it means, so I let that title go for myself. And I think it could be controversial. I'm not bringing it up to be controversial. I just woke up one day. There was plenty of, you know me, there's plenty, and you know me, there's plenty of times in my life where I want to be controversial. Mm-hmm. And so I would pick that as like something to start an argument in 12-step circles or whatever. But I started really messing with language and the Enlifted method and story work. And I remember calling Mark England one day and I'm like, bro, I don't think I can say alcoholic anymore because I'm not. I'm something else. Right. You know what I mean? But we were talking about the gratitude piece of I find myself on a regular basis now because I started training again. I'll be in the gym and I'll be like, dude, it wasn't too long ago. I couldn't pick this weight off the floor and put it up. I remember personally training somebody and I had to have her move the bar. I could barely stand up and it was like, I was, you know, and so now I'm able to do full workouts and do that. Mm-hmm. And the gratitude that I have and the experience, it prompted me to write that post about my girlfriend the other day. Mm-hmm. And like, so how do you bottle that up? Cause like every part of me that experiences something like that, it's like, oh, how do I get more of it? How do I get more of it? And I think the fact that it's something you have to work at is why it's so valuable. It's something that you curate versus like they talk about cheap dopamine and you just being, if I could put it in a syringe and shoot it up, I would, but it would lose its value.
It would totally lose its value.
It seems like a good idea at first. It's like whenever you chase the easy stuff, right? And so reminding myself today that it's the effort, it's the consistency, it's the reason that has such value is because you have to work for it. And it's not given to you every single day.
And that's just how life goes, dude. Like anything worthwhile is going to take time. It's always going to take time.
Well, time and effort, right?
Time and effort.
We talk a lot about, give me something in your life that's super valuable that is easy.
No. Nothing.
And people have a hard time.
Or not scary. Yeah. You know, I mean, I think about that. Like the most important things were always really scary before, you know, and things like that. And having a kid, you know, or launching a business, you know, like these things are scary and it's so easy to just fall into that. Like, nah, I'll play it safe. You know, I'm not going to risk it. And then you miss out on the most meaningful experiences you've had.
It's bizarre what goes on up here when you live up here. This is way more tolerable when you're living out here in the present.
Yes.
But it still shows up. It just doesn't have as much power. But man, the stories you can make up are absolutely insane.
Oh, dude. Yeah. But that's why regulation is so key. You know, all the work that we do. I mean, I do all the work. Like, we do. We live what we do.
Well, it's a way of life for sure. And I think that's our message to the people that come to us is that what he was saying is, yes, there's talk therapy. And I think a lot of people, I think there's an opportunity in some of our presentation and messaging. You could easily, I think, come up with an idea that we're not fans of talk therapy. And that's not necessarily true. I think it has its place. I don't think it does transformation the way it gets utilized. I do believe it needs to be timed properly. And I think the body needs to be considered first. And I think when you do talk therapy with a kid after a cold plunge, way different result than like trying to just get him. So it's really a timing issue. But most of the things that are transformative are not clinical.
Right.
Mm. They're just not. And that hurts some people. It heavy emphasis is placed on the clinical, and I understand why, and it has its place for sure. Mm-hmm. Most people struggling will see tremendous results with proper sleep, movement, and purpose.
Yeah, social connection.
And those are, now you may have a disordered sleeping thing that needs clinical attention, but like as a general category, sleep, purpose, and movement are not clinical.
Mm-hmm.
They're just not. They're lifestyle, right? So that's what I think our messaging is around, is like there's so many things that people need to practice. And I do believe in an outpatient setting, in a facility, giving people an opportunity to both experience clinical and lifestyle, that's the true blend of how do we match those two things up so that you can practice both of them? Because that's what you're doing when you go to treatment. And this is for anyone listening. And we all understand this from the gym, but at the facility, we're using language like training, not treatment, but we're training. It's practice. Like you're going there to practice. We're practicing what? We're practicing getting vulnerable. We're practicing how to learn a new vernacular so that we can put labels to our emotions. Because how do you talk about something if you don't know how to identify it, right? Yeah. Then what about consistency and showing up? And I'm practicing sitting in a group when I'm frustrated. And you see it all the time in group therapy, right? People get up and leave. Well, why are they leaving, right? They're going to tell you it's because they need to go to the bathroom. But chances are they're bored. They are, and I'm not saying that's the program's fault. I'm just saying they're experiencing something that's discomfort and they're checking out with it,
right?
I'm going to go distract myself. I'm going to go do this thing. So people being able to practice that. There's a lot to be said for sitting in discomfort.
Absolutely.
Even in, you know, long time 12-step. I mean, I did 12-step for many, many, many years. And what I witnessed, and even in that realm, is people being uncomfortable. What are you taught to do? What's the first thing they tell you to do? Pick up the phone. Mm-hmm. Call somebody. Mm-hmm. Great. Early on, yes. But if you always pick up the phone to call somebody when you are not feeling good, at what point does it transition from you helping me to me helping me and me regulating myself, right? And so it's like I'm calling you and I'm trying to manage my emotions with step work versus people would call me it, and it wasn't always like this. I just woke up one day and decided this is how we're going to do it. And they'd call me and expect me to give them some like gem, right? Mm-hmm. Some, and I'm like, okay, cool. Feel it. Call me back. Mm-hmm. What do you mean? Feel it. I'm like, you'll be okay. It's yeah. not going to kill you. Just experience it. People are like, what? Like, mm-hmm. let the sadness be. Let the, we're always trying to shift it, right? The the idea of shifting states. And I've seen great value in my own life for sitting in it. Mm-hmm. But the other day, dude, people wonder why I work out by myself. I love the group thing, but lately it's been, I need to be in the gym alone. Mm-hmm. And I'll wait for people to leave. I don't kick them out. I'm just like, I'll wait and work my schedule around when the gym clears out. And it's because I don't know what's going to show up. You know, like I wasn't able to move my body for 9 months. I was working out the other day, started bawling. Mm-hmm. And it was like in the past, what I would have done, I would have picked up more weight and moved it aggressively to like deny myself that. I just sat on a box and let it happen.
Right, yeah, it's the best.
Isn't that crazy? It's like super, super beneficial mm-hmm. to just let my body do what it needs to do and let the emotions happen. And we talk about it in group a lot. What's something that we as men learn real early on, and it's very innocent, but it's very, very damaging. Big boys don't cry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what are we really saying when we say big boys don't cry? We're saying that grown men do not allow a natural emotive process to take place.
Mm-hmm.
Does that feel like the messaging we want to be giving people?
Definitely not, bro.
But you get what I'm saying? It's yeah. like these things are, yeah. they're, it definitely wasn't intentional, but it messed me up for a
while. What brought it up? Was it music?
The other day?
Yeah. Like what brought up the emotion? Because sometimes music will do that to me in the workout.
So a little side note, what do they call that? Like, little secret or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I went on this road trip recently and I got hooked on this. It's called Viking rap. Uh-huh. So like Viking hip hop. I'm going to play you something, yeah. dude. It's the only, so if I ever need to wonder about my personality, archetype, all that, it's the only thing I've listened to for the last month.
Oh, wow.
Like I haven't played like yeah. different songs, but it's the only genre that's been on my radio. Like Kristen's like, dude, what the fuck? Like you got to stop. And, but what's funny is everyone who listens to it goes, hey, what is that? What is that? Yeah, right? Yeah. So I've been listening to that, but honestly, man, it's just been a real recognition of how bad it was for me with my sickness.
Yeah.
And just being able to move my body is like, well, he hit on it earlier, man. It's this idea of, I have no desire to break any records anymore. Like, I don't care about strength. I mean, I care about it to a degree of how does it operate and function in my life? Correct. How does it create a well-being in my life? But I'm not in there to like, and I really never was. I was pretty competitive in the sense of like, my performance was pretty competitive, like especially right before I got sick. But I was never in the gym looking at anyone. This is true, because some people might not believe it. I never looked at anyone in the gym and was like, I have to beat you today.
Yeah.
I just didn't operate that way. I knew who I had to be. And I generally was the one beating people because I was going against myself.
Mm-hmm.
But I just didn't have that in me. Like something about, I don't know when it happened, even with like, we would train, mess around with jujitsu or whatever. It was like, I didn't really have a desire to want to do that to anybody. Like I sort of lost that mm-hmm. drive. More about personal challenges and like that kind of stuff. And I think for me recently, it's just being able to move my body, dude. Yeah. Like I'm just literally grateful.
Yeah.
Grateful. I remember.
That's completely understandable.
I remember dreaming about my truck and wanting to go on trips and like not being able to climb in it. So.
Yeah.
You know, being able to like squat and get my heart rate up and you know it better than anybody. I can't imagine.
I used to be in that gym and just cry in that treadmill by myself, building myself back. So many emotions come up, you know, in, cause I work out a lot by myself too in the house, and just so many emotions come up in there, and a lot through music too. It's like therapy for me, dude. It's amazing. Movement is truly medicine.
I agree. And I think earlier, you know, at the beginning of this conversation, you asked like what my thoughts on, you know, emotion and being here and all that. I think, you know, one thing that really stands out, and I've talked to Jason about this, but just like the level of vulnerability that, like, you know, especially like you guys, like at you know, high up in this thing, it's just so rare and refreshing. I think most people that are in like a heavy leadership role in a mental health, you know, type of facility have this kind of great pressure. Like, I've got to always act like I've got my shit together at all times and I'm always fine. You're right. Like, that's the norm, you know, it's like people just being so, and so it's like, so, it's so nice, refreshing. Like, it allows me to, you know, feel like I get to take this armor off, you know, to be with guys and like, oh yeah, we can just be real, you know?
Yeah, like, it's the only way I need to be.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that's the truth, right? Like, even though like there's, you know, you might've been doing this recovery thing for a really long time, like, it's still the human experience, you know, and this shit's still hard.
Yeah.
And I still can suffer and be in pain and make bad choices and write and like not, you know, do the things I need to do and go through periods. So just to be able to, you know, hear guys like you like share openly about like, yeah, this is really hard, or this is what I worked through, or this is what I was going through. Like, that's actually not super normal, you know, like in this field, I feel like. Yeah. I feel like most people that are paid professionals kind of put on this hat of like, I'm supposed to be like solid, yeah, pretending at all times. And that's just really alienating, you know. It's so much more powerful and freeing for people to be like, oh, okay, so this dude's like 20, 30 years into this and it can still be hard. Like, that allows, you know, and that's really important.
Yeah. And I always say vulnerability breeds connection.
Yep.
Breeds healing too. And yeah, I mean, I wrote a book literally about my life. So I'm like literally an open book about everything in my life. And yeah, man, I think that, you know, the more that we could tap into that side within us, it's healing, bro.
Yeah.
You know, a good cry every once in a while is super healing for the soul. You know, cleanses us. It really does.
I told you, I cry all the time since I switched to the kids. Disney movies, had no idea how tragic every single one of them. Yeah.
I mean, they really are.
Yeah.
And it's brutal. It really is, dude. Some of these movies.
No, I've noticed in my sobriety over the years, like, it oftentimes happens alone, but there's been quite a few scenes in movies that got me, like, I'm relating to it in some way, or but I also feel like on the vulnerability piece and just being real, I don't know how you can be true to yourself if you're not.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think you can do it. And I never wanted to. Thank God I was given an opportunity with people helping me out to get started as far as building emotion financially, that I just wanted to, I didn't want to have to have a job where I had to pretend. Like, I just pretend that I respect you, that I like you, that like, I want to do business with you. It's like, I don't have to. I might choose to, but I don't have to. Right. And I get to just be me and be accepted for that. And, you know, I think one of the most powerful healing, and you guys may agree or may not, but I think one of the most powerful healing aspects of what I've been gifted is allowing myself to be seen. It's not being seen. That's really important. You have to allow someone to see you. And that means I have to take an action. I got to like to have the courage to share myself with you. And then if you see me, that's even more powerful. But I think it's just the act of me being willing. It's sort of like amends. Like, even if the amends doesn't, a lot of people are focused on like, I'm going to make this amends, and what if they don't accept it? That's not the point. The point is that you were willing to stand in that place and own what you had done wrong, right? Mm-hmm. That's where the real value is. And I think me being able to give myself an opportunity to be seen by others, and if even if it's not well received, like, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can see myself, and that's like pretty powerful.
Mm-hmm.
It's scary. When you first start doing that, it's really scary.
Oh, yeah. I mean, 'cause what's at risk, right?
Like, yeah.
Belonging and connection.
What if the critic was right the whole time?
Yeah.
And I let you see, you know, what's going on with me, and you're like, ooh, you know. And I think that's what's, I agree. I mean, in terms of like healing, you know, and I think about my relationship with my wife and all that, like just having somebody that's seen like all the craziness you try, you know, in your head and everything about you, and still be like, yeah, you're still my person.
It's the
like,
best.
And then you're like, oh my, yeah, like that's the most.
When you have an experience with somebody that annihilates the if you only knew,
yeah,
that's dope.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And then you want, and then like, you know, when you feel your partner's, it's like, man, I just wish you could like be in my head for a minute. You'd never feel insecure again. You know what I mean? Like, that's the wish we could do that. Just swap. Cause you know, even after years of marriage, you're still like, oh, what if this is the thing? Yeah. You're not going to like me, or, and it's just that unconditional, you know, it's like, I feel like my job for her, you know, is I'm like this mirror to reflect back to you of like who you really are, to fight all that shit, you mm-hmm. know? And that's what she does for me.
Yeah.
That's dope.
So many layers.
Yeah. Right?
But so much awareness through the whole process of recovery, right? We wouldn't be having this conversation 23
Well, I think it's ago, recovery, right? But honestly, man, I think it's like living life.
Yeah.
You don't get this just not doing drugs. Like, right. You got to be out there living.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I love the man in the arena quote. You got to be out there getting dirt and shit on your face mm-hmm. and blood and scars and getting beat up and licking your wounds and taking your broken shit to other people and sitting with. That's why having a tribe and having men and having so relationships that can provide that sort of care for you, it's so important. That's so why important. Doing life alone is so hard. It's, yeah. It wasn't never meant to be that way.
Nope.
We were never meant to be alone. We were always meant to be in community with each other, taking care of each other, even to the point of like, I think of like just single family homes. Like, we're really meant to be raising kids together. Like, you look at how hard it is. We always talk about that, right? Like,
yes, brother.
What's it like to be a single parent or even two great parents yeah. working? It's yeah. like, so having tribal people to be able to like, that's like,
we're missing that in society yeah. big time, brother.
I want to get back to that.
Me too.
You know, I crave that.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
And so we're starting that here with maybe not raising families and kids, but like being able to do the work together
yeah,
and have these conversations.
Absolutely. And, it's a, its own energy. It's like a family.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing. No.
What else you got?
I mean, I don't know, dude. My watch died. I don't even know what time it is. I don't have much more, dude. I mean, I think we dived into you guys' relationship. Where do you see yourself in the next 5 years?
Well, let's see. I mean, professionally, you know, I've always hoped that Jason and I would get to cross paths again in that role. I mean, he's certainly, like, you know, like I said, both personal and professional mentor. I've been watching him from afar, you know, as he's gone through his different chapters leaving Tucson. And yeah, I mean, I can't think of, you know, an organization that's like more in line with what I believe in, you know, and what I think, you know, creates healing and what I think is necessary, you know, in the world right now for anybody. Like you said, it's not about sobriety, right? Like, you know, just everything you guys are teaching and doing and offering the clients, like, that's what everybody needs right now. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I think it's, you know, like you said, I hope that society gets back more to the tribal, the community, the family. And it's like, yeah, we need to get back to like regulated nervous systems, mm-hmm. right? And like how to, you know, not get overstimulated and like, you know, navigate this world with, we have the same hardware that we've always had up here, but everything out here has changed so much beyond what the hardware doesn't get to update. You know, the brain mm-hmm. is with the brain. And so, you know, I feel like it's looking back into some of the ancient medicine tools you guys are using, community, connection, the hot, the cold, the exercise, you know, the movement, like that was the answer then. It's still the answer now. It's going to be the answer, mm-hmm. you know? So yeah, hopefully in the next 5 years, I mean, I would love to, yeah, link back up with Jason professionally and personally. You know, I've got another kid on the way. Like I said, my daughter will be born in October. So, I have to remember, how to have a baby. I mean, my youngest is six and it's right. crazy how much you forget.
Yeah,
like, oh, what's it like with a newborn again? I can't remember. Yeah. So
you'll pick it back up.
Yeah. Though. Yeah. I got to run it back on that.
Just really fucking tired.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. I could do that. Yeah. So, you know, really excited for that. Obviously, being a dad is like the coolest thing ever, as you know. And so just excited to meet another human in my family. And yeah, I think that's, I mean, other than that, just, yeah, continue to grow, continue to try to become better. I mean, these days I feel like I'm not even chasing like happiness or like any like huge goals. I'm just like always trying to orient towards like more peace. Is kind of what it feels like just always trying, like, how do I balance my life out to just feel more peace, more serenity, more centered, you know, because that's when I really get to like be the best of myself.
I agree.
You know, and so every decision I make and every kind of pro con I weigh out of what I want to bring into my life or where I want to put my life is kind of gauged against like, what is the cost going to be of my peace, you know, and how does that weigh out?
So if somebody was struggling out there, what's your message to them?
Man, that's a good question. If somebody is struggling out there, what's my, I don't know, like, you're not alone. like, I get it. I'm here. People are here. People love you. You know, don't give up. Like, man, I've had some dark times, you know, and I just think about, like, you know, just being mental health month in June, right? And that felt meaningful. It always feels meaningful when it comes around. I think about, you know, the amount of men that are, like, ending their life by suicide, you know, and the amount of men that are struggling, and everybody's struggling, women too, but just thinking of Men's Mental Health Month and my role professionally working with men that I have, like, just that it can be better no matter what you're feeling. Like, it can get better, and you got to reach out for help. You got to ask for help, and you're not alone. And I don't know. I just want people to feel like, because I know what it's like when you're suffering and you feel like you're alone, mm-hmm. you know, like in a room full of people, right? Mm-hmm. And that's like, and you just, I just wish, and I say this to myself because I don't do it oftentimes when I need to, but it's like, you just wish if there was somebody around you that was feeling like that, they would just say it. And that you could know, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Because you'd be like, oh, I got you, you know, mm-hmm. like, and sit with them and like be in that space. But yeah, I just hope that people can continue to like reach out and be authentic and be vulnerable and not put pressure, you know, or fake or mask. Because yeah, we're all going through hard times sometimes, you know.
Everybody.
And just because you do a lot of therapy or you become a therapist or you do this, like, it doesn't mean you got it all figured out, you know? And so, yeah, I don't know. It's tough to put a message to somebody that's struggling, but I would just say, like, you're not alone, you know? And please, like, ask someone for help.
Awesome. Yeah.
Whenever you ask that question, I was like, think about it. And I think I would, like, the thing that came to me today was, it's like, it's not true.
Yeah.
Like, because when you're in that place, like, alone and this thing is so off the fucking rails. Yep. And like, when you get to a place where if you come out of that, you look back and you go, how many people that you know have written about, like, they journaled about their struggles and then they go back to like, where was that?
Yeah.
Like, where was all that darkness? Like, how does that even, and just to be able to like, yeah, it's not true. Mm. It feels that way, but it's not true. Before we close, I was sitting here. I'm really grateful. It's interesting when I look at people just in general, and I think of like, one, the men that I want in my life, obviously you two are two of those people, but when I look at both of you, there's a lot of similarities, right? Like, lean, family's a priority, the way you show up for your kids, the language that you're using, that it's so incredible to be like, this is what it is for me. This is the people I want to be around. And it's no coincidence that you guys are living similarly, that you have like the stuff that you have going on. You have healthy relationships, your long-term 10-year marriage, 20 something years,
right? 30 years now.
Yeah. Yeah. So
marriage.
And so it's like the receipts, right? People say, show me the receipts. The receipts are like, look at your son.
Yeah.
Look at what he's doing. Look at the way he shows up.
Absolutely.
Look at when I see you and your wife together, like the energy that's there, the way that she shows up, right? You can't bullshit that. You can't fake that. You can't make that up. Like, that's shit's real. Mm-hmm. And so I think about what you two represent and how you show up in the world. And I'm like, of course they're going to be similar. Like, people who take care of their bodies, take care of their minds. You have a better chance of taking care of your mind if you take care of your body. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, you just do. You're generally speaking, there's a lot of fit people out there that are scumbags, but you guys are principled. You have constitution. You're committed to like servant mentality. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to say thank you guys for being both of those men, you know, like that's, I just recognized it right now. Like, damn, we're like, they're so similar.
We are very similar.
When you break it down, it's like, well, yeah, that's what people who do that, that's how they show up. Mm-hmm. Like, if we took 100 people and they took care of their bodies and they took care of their minds, and they had good relationships, we would say, oh, they look just like you guys. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So
thanks.
I don't know if that made sense.
It did. I appreciate that too, dude. Yeah. It's been an amazing episode, brother. Thank you so much
for
flying all the way out here from Arizona. And we appreciate you coming on. This episode is definitely going to help some people. People definitely follow us and are big supporters. So with that being said, where could they find you on social media?
Sure. Instagram. I had to look up what my handle was before this. I don't know. Peter Doyle 3838 is my Instagram. I'm not a huge influencer, but yeah, absolutely. Find me there if you need me and shoot me a message, and I'm here for anybody. Yeah.
Awesome. Do you have anything?
My handle's changed. It's The Emotion.
I know. So his handle changed. Yeah. As always, guys, thank you so much for coming on the show today. You could follow me at Instagram at FrankParisi2011. And then Jason changed his handle. I saw that the other day. At the THEE underscore motion guy. Also, make sure to follow us on Instagram at emotion.wellness.podcast, as well as at emotion.wellness.therapy. And also, please make sure to like and subscribe on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple. We appreciate you guys. We'll see you next week. We got like 4 guests this week, so we're going to be popping them out. Let's go.
Thank you for connecting with us on today's episode of the Emotion Podcast, where we discuss all things mental health. Connect every week as we explore incredibly intimate stories of persistence and hope. Delve into mental health education and explore valuable resources. Available on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And visit emotionwellness.com for more information.